This is the Skillist Podcast. Hey crew, welcome back to the pod. And I say this every time that it's going to be special, but this one actually is, like, because we're going to talk all things David Luteris, right? So many of you have said to me on social media, I get emails like, who is this mystery man? Like, who is David Luteris? Like, deep down. And so today we're going to deep dive right into it because his story is absolutely incredible, from starting out as a boy in Adelaide and then making his way onto the US tour as a 21-year-old looter. Is that right?
I was 22, actually, when I got my card. Yeah, 22.
And at the time, was that the youngest ever Australian or youngest ever?
Jason Day was the youngest. I was the second youngest. And actually, Anthony Kim, I think, is right around my age. So we were the three youngest out there in 2008.
Wow, pretty wild. But let's go right back to the start. Like, I want to go right back to the start. You know, where you were born, how you, like, even got into it, because your dad didn't even really play, you were saying. So, like, where is it in the family? Like, you know, talk about, like, where you're from and then how those very first early years of getting into the game all started.
Yeah, sure. No, well, he played a lot when I was younger, but he started the game late in life, I think in his 30s. So he wishes he started a lot earlier. But I guess I had a lot of natural talent when I was like 3 or 4, not that I remember. Sort of, I could chip the ball very well and hit the ball well. But then I actually played a lot of other sports, tennis, Australian rules football. And then I had a buddy at my school when I was about 12, who was really into golf, and I went out and played with him, and definitely could still play. And then from out of nowhere, about a year later, I came runner up in the state junior amateur to Henry Perks, and Adam Bland, who I have spent a lot of time with. So played in the junior state team at 14 in Australia, and never really looked back. Still played a lot of other sports, but I really sort of caught the bug and became obsessed with the game.
So that's pretty incredible. So, like, the acceleration from starting the game to, like, becoming, you know, basically national level was literally a few years, just a couple of years. But, like, because you started at 12, like, is that right? Like, you can't have started at 12, did you?
Yeah. Well, no, I said I could play when I was, say, 3 or 4, like, pretty well. I could chip the ball consistently.
Gotcha.
But, yeah, no, I really didn't play seriously until I was probably 12, 13. And then, yeah, when I was 14, I was on the junior state team, and then played the, you know, state stuff and then started playing the national stuff. So it all happened pretty quickly and, quite honestly, unexpectedly.
But, okay, so let's stay with that. So you basically get into the state junior team. At that stage, were you – like hyper aware, wow, I'm already even better than these guys that I'm playing with, like, I'm seriously good at this game? Or, and did you, had it occurred to you might end up playing in America at that stage? Did you even know what the PGA Tour was? Was that an aspiration early on? And did you feel like you were better than the guys that you were playing with it, even at 14?
I had glimpses where I had a couple, you know, course records in the next couple of years where I thought, wow, I can actually play, you know. But no, because when a couple guys, Rick Kulak, who's still a friend, Michael Sim, who's still a friend, they came and stayed at my house for these junior events. I mean, they were comfortably better than I was at that time. So I had no, you know, I had no illusions that I had a long way to go. But my short game was exceptional and kind of just kept getting better and better. And then when I was, say, 17, went to the Australian Institute of Sport with a bunch of guys. And then that sort of took, you know, my game to a whole nother level, no question.
So you were, how old were you when you went to the AIS?
17, I believe.
17, right. So junior team, 14, you're at the AIS at 17. And they, how many guys were in that group? There's only about 10 or 12, is there, or something like that?
I think it was 10 guys and I think 8 girls, for the best sort of from around the country.
Okay.
So looking back, it was brilliant stuff because You know, I guess the guy who was the first coach there, Ross Herbert, who I guess tragically passed away. I never got to meet him, but he was, I guess, Brett Rumford's coach back then with all the short game stuff. And what they taught us around the greens, I mean, all of the guys in there, our short games were very, very superior to it. Even when I went and played around the world at that point. It was really great stuff.
Yeah, right. That's incredible. So, but at the same time, like, you're getting validation by, all right, you've got a letter from the AIS, right? So you're getting sponsored by the country to come and, you know, work in Canberra. So was it based out of Canberra? No.
No, it was actually in Sandringham, Melbourne. It was in the... Yeah, they had a house right near Sandringham Range, and fortunately, we all got membership. So I was a Metropolitan Golf Club as a member while I was there, because that was, I guess, like a reciprocal of Kionga, where I'm at in Adelaide. So I would go there, play and practice on weekends, and then with the squad, we'd all grind together all day. It was really good looking back.
We should have, I don't know if you know, but like Sandringham's been completely redone, like the whole golf course. It's like a mini sandbelt track now. Like they fully, you know, they brought in all of the curators from Royal actually come across and do everything. And it looks, it's like a short little track, but the green complexes and bunkering are like Royal. So you stand over like a 60-meter pitch and you just can't even imagine it staying on the greens. So they've done such a great job for a little, public track, but it's also now where Golf Australia and the PGA, like all of the development stuff, they built a new driving range. It's epic down there. So,
anyway, oh, that's great. That's great.
A little bit besides the point, but the but at this, you're getting validation this entire time, right? So you're getting picked now, right? I'm in the top 10 guys in the country, right? What's going through your head at that stage? Like, are you super competitive? This is pretty special. Like, I'm absolutely loving everything, and I can see like the steps I need to take to get to the US. And probably at that stage, it was very much in fashion in Australia. Maybe a little bit post that, because the fashion was like what A. Scott did, wasn't it? Where you go to Europe, right? No one ever, or back then, you wouldn't go straight to America. You would do your time, you know, you'd, like a Richard Green or like, you know, like a Rummy or like a Scott, you'd go over there. And Bads was the first one that didn't. Is that right? Do you remember that? Like Bads was like, no, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to go straight to America. Like what were you, were obviously validated. You felt like you were the best in the country. Like what was your, what were you thinking and like what were you thinking your next steps had to be?
Yeah, I didn't see why not. You couldn't go straight to America. Used to watch the PGA Tour on TV every Monday morning, like most Australian golfers, you know, get up early and watch the final rounds, as well as obviously the majors. But I always just had my sights and heart set on America. I'm not sure why, to be honest, probably because of Tiger Woods and, you know, all your idols on TV. So, but I did go to Asian Q School and got some tiny bit of status that first year and in Australia. But then I went and played the mini tours in the States. Adam Bland and I went over. Might be the best golf I've played to this day, actually. 2006. I think I averaged about 15, 16 under per event in Arizona. Yeah, I was playing great. Actually, what's that, bud?
4-day events or 2-day events? What were they?
3 to 4-day events. Actually, a buddy of mine here, Steve Marino, who played on the tour for 10 years, we were talking. He won the Gateway Tour Championship. He shot 59 and then had a great career on the PGA Tour. I think he played out there for 11 years. But so there's some really good players battling it out there. Kevin Streelman was out there playing.
Yep.
But yeah, so I got a taste of American sort of pro golf, even though it was smaller. And, and then Jacobs Creek at my home course, which was quite lucky to play in that. I came runner-up, and that got me on the Korn Ferry Tour and sort of never looked back.
Who won it that year, the Jacobs Creek?
I got Scott Sterling, who actually battled some injuries. But he played on the big show as well. He played on the PGA Tour.
Right.
But then Mark Leisha and myself, James Nitties, would travel around the country sharing rental cars, just trying to qualify every week. We did it for the whole year that year. And
all three of you got status out of that one
Leishman got on Korn Ferry, but I ended up getting on the PGA Tour. I got all the way through Q School, so I came top 25. So before you know it, yeah, I went from, you know, Monday qualifying on Korn Ferry to the PGA Tour, which was crazy. I was in signed up for the Sony Open a month or so later.
Wow. So, okay, so you've got stages on the Korn Ferry, which at the time was the Nike Tour, was it? Or the Buy.com? It was probably Buy.com or something.
It was the Nationwide Tour.
Oh, it was Nationwide, right? Okay. All right. So you get status on that, and through that status and where you finish that year, you then get access to go to Q School, essentially, right? So is that right?
Yeah, but I had to go all the way through. I went through first stage, second stage, third stage.
Okay. So for everyone out there, explain how intense Q School used to be, right? The way it was.
Actually, the professor today talking about it, how much he dreads it. Yeah, it's the biggest pressure cooker in golf, because if you play well, you're on the tour. If not, you've kind of got nothing. You're qualifying, you're scrapping mini tour events, and it's really one, I guess, event a year that determines the entire year. So the pressure is kind of hard to explain unless you've done it. It's for some reason, I always play better in it. I don't know why. I wish I could have bottled that up playing tournament golf, but I always actually played better at Q School.
And how many rounds did you have to get through to get into the top 25?
It was 4 for first stage, 4 for second stage, and then 6 for final stage.
Wow, that's crazy. Yeah. And where did you finish inside the top 25?
The first time I got through, I finished 23rd on the number, and I bogeyed the last hole to get in on the number. God.
Wow, yeah. That's
crazy. Yeah. I almost blacked out. I was so nervous. I can't even really remember it, but it was just such a relief to get through. I remember Greg Chalmers in the group in front missed like a 6-footer, and he was back on Korn Ferry. If he made that, he was on the PGA Tour.
Wow, that's so incredible. I saw Greg the other day, actually, at the PGA show. Great man. So much taller.
He's great. I mean,
he's so much taller.
One of the greatest putters of all time. One of the greatest putters ever, Greg.
One of the greatest putters. And he's still a grinder. Like, he's really interesting. Like, he still works at his game. I don't know if you follow him on Instagram. He actually does a bunch of putting lessons on Skillets, believe it or not. But
he does.
He still grinds really, really hard. He's had some body issues, like, in the past, but he's still a grinder. It's absolutely incredible. But so you're 17 when you're in the AIS. You go from there. Is that when you went to America to play, and then you went back and played the Jacobs Creek, and then back to America once you actually had status? Was that the order?
No, it was about 19. No, it was 20 or 21 when the Jacobs Creek happened. Gotcha. That was after AIS. That was just post AIS.
Okay. All right. Fantastic. So, all right, you go through Q School. This is insane, right? Like, so you are then 20, 21, 22. You get your card, and then what was that feeling like? Like, do you remember the feeling of getting your card? And was there a sense of expectation of even getting your card? Did you also think, oh, I'm good enough? Did you have, what was the doubt versus the, you know, the confidence level, if you know what I mean? Like, so, sometimes when you're that young, it's like, I just expected it. Like, I thought I was good enough, and, like, you know, you didn't overthink it and you just got it. Was it much of that? Or did you feel like, I don't belong here, I don't know how I've even got here?
No, it was definitely, I had a little bit of that, but I absolutely believed I could do it. I mean, I don't think anyone who gets through that doesn't think they can, right? That's just you have to believe you can do it. But yeah, the feeling was total elation. Actually, the first voicemail I got was from Jason. I don't know why I remember that, but he was so pumped, which was really cool, because we'd spent a lot of time playing and practicing together, and he'd already got his card through Korn Ferry. He came third on the money list, but I had to jump on a plane straight that night back to Australia for the Australian PGA Championship. So, and Cole Swatton, who was Jason's coach at the time, we sat next to each other, and he was so pumped for me. So that was a fun flight. And then landing in Queensland, and then had to do the press conference. And it was pretty special. I can still remember that.
Amazing. I actually just played Coolum like 2 weeks ago, Luna.
Yeah, I love that golf course. I know that changed it a bit, but that was a fun track.
It's changed a little bit, but oh my God, it's awesome. Unfortunately, they've just let it go because old Clivey Palmer came in and took it over, and the condition of it's not great, but it sort of doesn't I mean, obviously you want the greens to be perfect, but when the layout's that good, it's just fun hitting shots. You know what I mean? Like, it's such a great
event. Yeah, everyone loved that event. It was such a fun event on the Aussie Tour.
Oh, he stuffed that up royally, that's for sure. But anyway, okay, so you came back. How did you play in that event? Do you remember thinking, God, I'm on
top of the world? Yeah, I think I came top 20. I know it was top 20. It wasn't great, but I think it was like 18th or something. But I was exhausted, but I was also feeling pretty good about myself, obviously. I just, you know, I knew I was going to the Sony Open, my first event, just a few weeks later in Hawaii. So it was kind of surreal knowing I had to sort of prepare for that.
And what were you, like, in terms of funds and everything that you had to actually participate in the tour? Because, like, at that age, it's not like you've spent a couple of years, like, building up, you know, oh, I've been winning some events and I've got, like, a little some purses behind me. Like, did you sort of look at it and go, and like, did you have sponsors that came in and helped you, like go to the next level? Like, how were you thinking about that sort of stuff, like the actual logistics of surviving on tour for the first year?
Yeah, back then, every club company had a table at the in the clubhouse after Q school with contracts ready to sign for guys who got their card. So,
wow.
Yeah, so you're signing a very nice deal back. I think a lot of it's changed now as we're talking with Ryan. But back then, if you got on the tour, you got a very nice deal. And I had a few sponsors. So that was really good. That was fine, you know. But it's still expensive. You're paying for your caddy, flights, all of that stuff. But, yeah, look, it was good.
And then when did the, you know, the realization – I mean, I can't even remember back then, but it was still probably top 125 that you've got 1 year to finish inside that 125 to retain your card. Like, was it when was the honeymoon over a little bit and you're like, shit, like, I've got to make some cash here?
Well, I played, I didn't know anyone except for Jason and I knew Aaron Baddeley, but I didn't know anyone except for Dustin Johnson. So, Dustin and I played two of the last three rounds of Q school together. And so we texted and played practice round at Sony, practice round at the next event. So I didn't know anyone, which was kind of, you know, nerve-wracking because you're this is new kid on the block. And I think when it hit me was when I started hitting balls on the range. Ernie Els came next to me and he was still a big deal. He still is a big deal forever, but I think he was top, you know, five in the world at the time or something. And then I think VJ was next to me, and I was just like, holy smokes, you know, this is happening, you know? And yeah. I struggled with it a little bit, to be honest. I couldn't believe I was hitting balls next to my idols at that point. I'll be brutally honest. And at times I conquered it, but yeah, it was a challenge.
Oh my God, it must have been. So, like, how did you go at Sony? So, I think we've talked about it like briefly. I mean, the hilarious.
Terribly, terribly, terribly. I remember one of the few times I could hardly tee the ball up on the first day. I was so nervous.
Oh my God, I could imagine the people standing around you and like, so.
Yeah, and it was a big crowd, but it was just your first tour event, you know, and you only get one first tour event. And for some reason, I was incredibly nervous, but got through that. And then I actually started playing. I played well at Greg Norman's event, Mayakoba. I was in the final group on Saturday, which is my third event on tour.
Okay.
Started working with a sports psychologist because I knew I needed one, and he helped me quite a bit. But I just never quite cracked it. I had some swing issues, but so it was interesting. It was definitely a steep learning curve.
So what do you? So when you say swing issues, like you just couldn't control the flight the way you wanted it. It didn't quite start on the lines you wanted it to. Just felt that little bit out of control. Like his short game was obviously always super sharp, but you just always felt like I don't exactly know where my driver's starting or where my iron's. Like what was it in particular?
Yeah, it was both actually. And you know, now it's funny how the world works. Like it's a bit of a blessing now at being a coach because I kind of tried everything. I bought every single book. I knew what swings I liked and I read everyone's books, Jack's and Nick Price's and Hogan's. But in my experience, you really cannot coach yourself. So if you're listening out there, you must get a coach because even to this day, I still can't fix my own swing. I can kind of fix other people's, no problem. But, so yeah, I tried everything and then I linked up with a coach in Texas later that year after months of experimenting, and it was just it wasn't a good situation, and he helped me a lot, and then it took about 4 months with him to get my swing back. And then the next year I was off the tour, but I played great. I won three or four big mini tour events. And then I got back through Q school. So
unbelievable.
Yeah, I think I shot 18 under, 19 under in the first stage, second stage next year, and then actually came sixth. So Billy Horschel came second. I think Ricky Fowler came seventh at Q school that next year. Some big names again. And I really, that whole year I played well.
That is incredible. So leading into that, so you get your card back again after, you know, losing it. How far out of the top 125 were you when you lost it? Like way out?
I was way out. I think I was like 200th or something out of probably 260. But some guys have only got conditional, so they're not playing all the events. But yeah, that final, it was interesting. The final round of the second time, I shot the low round of the day in the wind, 64 at a tough course, and jumped from 35th to 6th. Wow. I was nine under through 13 and really didn't miss a shot.
That is amazing. And then, wow, so you get back on and then go straight back to the Sony Open, I suppose.
Yeah, I made the cut, and I made the cut that time, which was nice, but it was still a little uncomfortable, to be honest. I still felt, wow, here we are again. I was only 23 or 4, I guess, that second year out there. So, but I did make a bunch of cuts early, and I thought, here we go. But I just fell into some bad swing issues, and it was interesting.
That is interesting. Have you got your old action on camera, like what it looked like back then?
I do, you know what? It's somewhere. I wish I could have it from those mini tour days. It's somewhere on a like a digital camera before the iPhone, I guess. So I wish I could see it. But basically, I was very on plane, pretty neutral, nothing crazy, and I could really hit any shot I wanted. Low fade, high draw, low draw. I could kind of do what I wanted with the golf ball.
Right. But at the same time, you didn't feel like it was quite right. Like, how do you sort of reconcile those two differences? Do you know what I mean? Like, you can.
Yeah, no, I got into habits. I think, I think every golfer goes through this, but you get into, sometimes you might, you know, not be staying on top of it as much as you should, and it can retreat back to a bad, you know, pattern. And I think every great player works on their swings, has a coach. You've got to stay on top of it. It takes constant, you know, tweaking and constant, keeping it kind of where you want it. It really does.
Well, that's what, like, you know, my experience, like when I used to work at the Glades on the Goldie with Gary Edwin, right? Like, Camps, Wannard, like Gal, Gavin Coles, Guards, like they all had their US tour cards, right? And they were working with guests at the time, right? And they'd fly back, they'd spend 2 weeks getting it all like honed in. Everyone would like put their model swings on camera and be awesome. Like they'd be absolutely dreading it. They'd go away for 8, 9 weeks, 12 weeks or whatever, fly back to see Gaz, you know, for tune up. And it was literally that their patterns were completely gone back to their old shit. You know what I mean? Like completely.
100%.
Yeah, it was like they hadn't even like changed it. You know what I mean? So it just shows you that, like, even with great instruction, like if you're, you know, not really staying right on top of it, like, it can, you know, it can leak and just go back to what it was, you know. Like Gary always says, like, you're always in remission. Like your pattern is always wanting to go back to the bad stuff, and you've just got to be like on it, you know, the entire time, sort of thing. So run us through that second season. Like what happened? You made the cards.
Yeah, so I started off well, made a bunch of cards, and then again just kind of was, I just didn't have it, and it was a bit of a battle. And then, so I lost my card again that year, went on to Korn Ferry, didn't play great. And again, I probably experimented way too much with different swings and just trying to get something that just sort of held up. I really tried everything. I don't know if there's a method that I haven't tried, which now I said as a coach is almost a bit of a blessing, because if someone comes to me with, you know, I've tried this and this, I can be like, well, for you, that might not be the best thing to do, you know. So it's funny how now it's actually a good thing that I did that. But from a playing perspective, it's certainly not what you want to do. I think you're better off having a clear direction and just going towards that, not trying all these different things, which so many lessons we all give, you know, the students watch this on YouTube or this on Instagram, and they're all over the place. They don't even know what they're doing.
So it sounds like what's interesting is that it doesn't sound like you really got someone to have a really good hard look at what you were doing with your full swing until you were on the PGA Tour. Is that fair enough to say? Like, you know, if you look at like Grant Field and Cam Smith or Cam McCormick and Jordan, like they literally started when they were 11 and 12 and worked on the exact same stuff for the entire time. Like, as Grant says, like, I mean, when I'm there, I'm pretty much just like his mirror and just babysitting him because, like, I don't tell him too much different to what we did, you know, 12, 13 years ago sort of thing. So you obviously didn't have that. Do you feel like that could have changed things a little bit if you had got onto stuff a touch earlier and just, like, had someone there the entire time rather than changing when you got?
Yeah, and I think I was seeking something that maybe doesn't – I was almost not seeking perfection, but I was just trying to find that thing that would just, you know, the swing or technique that would just be bulletproof. And, you know, you read Nick Price's book or Nick Faldo's, and they kind of did do that, actually. They rebuilt their swings, and for a period they both got to world number one and had beautiful ball control. I kind of thought I could do that. I really believed I could do that. And you know, some players are better off just, as you said, sticking to what works for them.
Well, the problem is as well is that you are so close, you know what I mean? Like, you're not just close, you're actually there, right? So in your mind, you probably feel like maybe if I just change my setup a little bit, like, that'll be enough to get me onto it. Or if I just, like, change my wrist angles at the start, or if I turn in a slightly different direction, or just, like, if I just do one little thing, because you're so close, you know what I mean? It'd be very tempting to probably experiment with a lot of little things that, you know, feel like will just give you that 1% that will, you know, get you, you know, to the level of, you know, top 70 in the world and retain your card every year sort of thing. So I could imagine that happening. I remember, like, I mean, you know Craig Spence. You know Spencey very well.
Yeah, absolutely, of course.
Craig Spencey's a great man. I coached next to him for a decade pretty much. Yeah, literally for a decade. And, I mean, his stories are just unbelievable about going to Q school and, like, you know, but he played on tour for about 4 or 5 years, I think. You know what I mean? I think he finished third at the Bridgestone 1 year. You know, he sort of had some pretty good results. He talks about how his Q school stories are hilarious, like where he literally went out on the final day of final stage. He shot like 66 in a cyclone, and he literally jumped up to like third or something like that. And he literally called his wife and said, "We're back on tour, baby. Like, this is all happening. This is the last day of final stage." And he reckons he sat there just watching the scores come in, and it was like 65, 65, 64. And his name just kept going like this. And he missed by two. He missed his card by two spots or something. And he was just like, "That's it. I'm never doing it ever again. I'm done." You know, and he was probably 28 or 29. And anyway, but he also talks about how he changed his goal settings when things were going well. He reckons he did a bit of tweaking. He and his coach sort of, like, his coach didn't like the way something looked, and he just changed it a little bit, and he reckons it changed overnight. It never came back ever again sort of thing. So, you know, and it only needs to change by that much, doesn't it? You know, it only needs to, like, God, that's just missed by three.
Well, especially at that level, you know, at that level, the lines are so fine. And, you know, everyone out there is so great on these tours. I don't think the average golfer realizes the difference between even, say, at your club, a plus three or four marker compared to a tour pro. There is a massive difference. And, you know, one little part of the game off, that's all it takes to not keep your card or not be competitive.
Yeah. And yet there's also these guys that, like, somehow make it all work even when it looks like it's got big flaws in it, you know. You know, not just the way a golf swing looks, but, like, you know, some people just don't have a great, like, you look at a guy like what was the tiny little South African's name? Clark.
Tim Clark. Yep.
Oh my god, what was his name? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Tim Clark.
Tim Clark. Yeah. I mean, Tim Clark literally was I don't know if you ever saw him chip a golf ball, but, like, it was He couldn't chip. Like, he would only play on golf courses that had, like, fluffy surrounds on the green. Like, couldn't take him to Royal Melbourne or something like that. He literally, like, lay a sod over it, but yet could still play at the elite level probably for 12, 13, 14 years. Like, it's so, it's just like, there's just so much mystery there, I think, as well, isn't there, where you can have massive flaws but still somehow manage to stay out there. So it's bizarre.
You got to be good, like, between the years. The better you get, a lot of it starts becoming between the years as well.
Totally. Exactly. I couldn't agree more. And so you lose your card, right? You lose your card.
Yeah.
Was that it? You're like, I'm just sort of done a little bit? Or how much did you then try for another tour? So at that stage, you're 24 or something like that, second time you lose your card. What does the next 2 or 3 years look like? And were you exhausted? Were you like, is this like really, do I want to go through this all over again?
Yeah, a little bit. And then I ended up going to, I wanted somewhere to play. So I went back to Australia, got my card there, went to Asia, started playing on the Asian tour and the China tour, and played in India and Bangladesh and all these crazy places. So that was a crazy few years.
Amazing.
Yeah, it was, well, that's certainly one way to put it. It was amazing. And yeah, so that's what I did for a few years. And then I ended up going back and playing some Korn Ferry events, qualified, started playing well. And then I had that accident, that quad bike accident, which really sort of stopped. That's when I knew, I was like, I'm not going to be doing, not playing professionally anymore, because I didn't even know how I was going to be physically.
Do you want to talk about that? So that was serious. Or not really?
What's that, bud?
Do you want to talk about what happened there or not really?
Yeah, sure. That's fine. Yeah, I was just on a quad bike and I had a bad accident and had a 2-day concussion, shattered my entire face and broke a rib, but I was in bad shape. I didn't even know if I'd go to play golf again, to be honest. And and that's when Jason was in between caddies. So I went and did a few months on the bag for Jason, which was great learning experience again, because again, we played with Tiger Woods and Rory McIlroy. And I really observed and learned from that little period. I learned a lot from Jason, just how professional he is and the way he practices, and just being around the world's best players was brilliant for the coaching side.
Yeah, right. Oh my God, totally. But it did, when you were out there watching Tiger hit it and J-Day and like these guys did it, did you think to yourself, hey, if I can get healthy again, I'm as good as these guys? Or did you see it and go, that's a different level? That is a different level. Like, maybe it's time to find another career path.
I'd say all of those guys, they have one part of the game where you feel that. So when you see Rory hit a driver, it's pretty, you're not going to be able to match that. Or when you see Jason chip and putt under pressure, you think, wow, that's pretty rock solid. Or you see Tiger hit the iron. So they're all brilliant at a certain things, but no, not really. I mean, they're still human. It's not totally unachievable. But yeah, mentally, I was just kind of done at that point. And again, I was around Cole Swatton so much. I was around all these coaches and I was learning, even though I'd already tried all these things anyway. So it was just a natural progression to get into the coaching, and I really enjoyed it. And it's been many, many years now.
It is interesting you say, like, searchers, we call them searchers, the people that are out there looking for something every day, they always end up, like, as players, I'm talking about the type, like, Scotty Gardner wasn't so much, but like, guards would just go and do what he was told, and he wouldn't go and like be reading books at night or on YouTube. He'd just go and just flush it, absolute ball striker guards. I used to love watching that. And then other players at the top level, like, were the opposite. They'd be like asking other guys, what are you working on? And what are you working on? And maybe I should do a bit of that. And it was always that person that ended up the great coach, because they were so inquisitive and they wanted to know so much about the golf swing itself for themselves, because they wanted to figure out if someone knew something they didn't know that could help them. But also because, they're just so inquisitive and they want to learn.
Yeah, so you're 100% correct. Some guys are way better off knowing nothing, and then some guys want to know it all. They want to know, why does this happen? Why do, so... And I was definitely in that second category. Even the way, going back to the AIS, I remember, a couple of the coaches there. One was very simple, like the keep it simple, very good coach. But the other one was incredibly technical. And I actually preferred, you know, finding out why this happens and, you know, why does this, you know. So I was in that other category, but I think as a coach, you got to know what your student is. You can't give too much info to a student who doesn't want it. That's definitely something I try to, you know, do myself as a coach.
Yeah, no, oh, mate, I think, well, you've landed in a great spot. We can't talk about where you coach, I don't think, but, you know, everything you've done is just, you know, led you to this place, which, you know, how old are you now? 38.
38, yeah. Yep. So it's been, I feel like I'm 60. No, I'm just kidding. But it's been a long ride. But, yeah, it's great. And you never stop learning, I'll tell you that much. I'm lucky enough to sort of rub shoulders with some great players, you know, tour players and coaches. And it's fun having conversations. And, you know, they bounce ideas and it never ends. You really do never stop learning in the game of golf. It's unbelievable.
So, okay, so as we sort of wrap this up, because it's a pretty amazing story, Luter, and, everyone could obviously learn from you on Skillist, and then obviously you're in Florida if anyone wants to come get some in-person lessons from you. But if there's a 17, 16-year-old kid that's listening to this right now, like, what would you tell them? You know, what is the number one piece of advice you would give that kid who is, like, literally doing everything, is on the exact same path as you? They're playing in a state team, you know, they're feeling great about what they're doing, they can see, like, a pathway to get to America. What's the one piece of advice you would give them?
Be aggressive and believe.
Believe.
Yeah, and be aggressive. Yeah. Go for it. You can't wait for it or hope it's going to happen. You have to go get it, because there's a lot of other guys maybe as good as you, maybe not, but if they've got that attitude and you don't, in the end they're going to probably get ahead of you.
And does that extend to their golf game as well? Do you think you need to be hyper aggressive now with your golf game?
I'd say definitely you got to play aggressive golf, you know, in terms of have power off the tee and all that, but I think it's more just a mindset and an attitude and just believing that you can achieve it. You really do have to have that. And for whatever reason, guys like us in Australia tend to battle that a little more than Americans. So over here, you see a lot of it. It's incredible. But that would be my advice.
Awesome, mate. Well, that was a great conversation. I mean, you've just had an incredible career. As I said to you, you know, off air or before the pod, like, maybe 100 guys have ever, you know, Aussies have ever made the US tour. So to be able to say you've done that and, you know, to play at such a level is absolutely incredible. And to get where you've got, I'm just absolutely rapt for you, mate. But, yeah, you'll have to come back at some stage. You know, we were saying that, you know, it's time for you to come back to Oz. You're out here for a couple of years during the pandemic, but, mate, we'd love to have you back and play at your fabled Cooyonga, and maybe we can have a hit together and I can see that ball fly.
Oh, I'd love to do it. We will do that. Maybe late May or June. Let's make that happen.
Done. All right, team. Thank you so much. That was a really great conversation. If you have any questions, hit us up. I'm at Baden@skillist.com. You can generally DM me on socials, which is at Baden Chat. Not too many of us out there, so that was a pretty easy handle to get. And Luter, like, if people want to get in contact with you, what's the best way to have a chat?
Yeah, you can DM me on Instagram or on Skillist. Absolutely, feel free to reach out. Love to answer any questions or help you with your golf game. Always enjoy doing it.
Awesome, great man. We'll speak to you again next week.
You got it, brother.